Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au. Struggling to find tomorrow's breakout stocks on the ASX? With thousands of listed businesses, knowing how to spot the next rising star is hard. The Intelligent Investor Australian Equity Growth Fund cuts through the noise and invests in highly profitable owner-operated businesses. While past performance doesn't indicate future performance, IIGF has delivered an impressive 12.4% annual return since launch in October 2020 up to the end of April 2024. Investors will gain exposure to a concentrated portfolio of Aussie equities with considerable growth prospects. For a limited time, invest in ASX IIGF with zero brokerage fees directly with Intelligent Investor. Visit intelligentinvestor.com.au for details.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Mitchell Sneddon, how are you going, mate?
I'm good, Owen. How are you doing?
Pretty good, mate. Pretty good. Looked like you got a good jumper on there, a good Rask polo or something like this.
You've branded me from day one.
Well, what can I say? Today, we're going to be talking about ETFs and passive income. We're going to reflect on our one-month celebration. I don't know if it's 1 month into Rask Invest. I don't know if we can call it something like that, but we're just going to share some insights from what you've learned so far from the community. We're going to talk about the different types of ETFs that you can use to build a 5% passive income in retirement or pre-retirement, the different kind of building blocks that go in there, and why ETFs tend to make sense, despite what a lot of, I guess, perceptions may be. But you and I were just chatting off air about something called the three bucket strategy. And I said to you, I don't know what this is, but then it later turns out I probably do know what it is. But can you explain it for anyone that's watching or listening? What is it?
Yeah, sure. So we were having a chat about different income topics and income strategies came to my mind. And I said to you, Owen, hey, how about we chat about three bucket strategy, to which you were blank on. And then when I explained it, you caught up on it. Rightio, so I think this is a very common strategy for financial advisors. It's a very simple strategy as well for people to have in their minds. It's a common strategy that financial advisors use with their clients. And it's essentially where they break up the their retirement savings or a client's investments into three core components or three buckets.
Mm-hmm.
First bucket is the trying to think what end to start at. Let's start at the growth end. So the first bucket will be the growth, and this is the largest bucket. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you have all your growth investments, investing for the long time in your equities and whatnot. Because just think about it, if you're retiring in your 60s and your average life expectancy is what I'm guessing it's probably now in Australia, the mid to high 80s,
mm-hmm.
People are living longer. And so you're living in retirement mode a lot longer. So you're going to need your capital to actually continue to grow to fund for your retirement into the future. You then have a second. So that's the largest bucket. You then have the second bucket, which is more of a medium term kind of style bucket. It's generating income for you. Mm-hmm. And it can be then topping up the bottom bucket, which is your here and now and your, say, approximately 2 years of cash. So think about what you're going to spend in retirement or your living expenses, your holidays, et cetera, et cetera. You do not want that money at risk from things like the stock market and fluctuations in the global markets. So, that's, I guess, the kind of three bucket strategy that a lot of advisors use when they're
doing
some retirement planning for clients.
So basically you have this long-term growth strategy, which would be like in the 5-7 year window. Like that's that one. Then you've got the 2 years of cash, and then you got everything that's left over is like juicing that income, like that income bucket of the 2 year cash.
Yeah, that's right. And you kind of over time rebalance between the three.
At the time of recording, there's a lot of talk at the moment now of interest rates potentially going up in the short term, in the very short term. And I often think about this. Alan Kollo, who did a really good ABC report, I think it was based on CBA data. I think it was like late last year or early this year. He basically showed data that suggested that retirees and older demographics are the ones that are spending more than before. And if we think about this three bucket strategy, if we increase interest rates, that demographic will probably keep spending and be able to spend more, because that 2 year buffer of cash flow is earning 5.5% of income. So that's pretty unreal when you think about where we were 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they're essentially kind of creating a bit of a, and it's been around for a little while now, it's not a new thing, a bit of a two-speed economy between the whichever way you want to paint it, between the haves and the have-nots, people with large chunks of cash and people like retirees, and now, you know, it's been a decade since they've had it so good. in terms of the interest that they're earning on their cash.
Yeah, and fair enough. They had to go a long time. It was a long, cold winter of interest rates falling for retirees. So fair enough. So so we'll probably come back to that in a little bit anyway. But we're 1 month into the launch of Rask Invest, which is our investment service that people can invest with us. And I'd refer anyone to the product disclosure statement, or PDS, and the target market determination, or TMD. Both of those are available via the show notes. But I'm just curious, you're at the coalface speaking with a lot of people day in, day out. What have been some of the highlights?
And one thing I do want to mention is, I know a lot of a few people who listen to this have actually said, oh, is it open? It is open for investment. We've kept it for the first month, we kept it pretty quiet, and we went out and we went out exclusively to people who put their name on a pre-registration kind of list. Yep. So it's been 1 month of really focusing on those early adopters who are some of your biggest fans, Owen. They've followed the podcast for many, many years.
We love them. Yep.
And they're absolutely fantastic. So something I've spoken to a lot of them over the last month. What has really caught my attention has been the level of sophistication and knowledge. And I think that's testament to the great job you've done with this podcast and the various other Rask Group podcasts over the years. They're all super keen for dollar cost averaging. They're all super keen for stock market pullbacks. they are very, very keen. They know what they want to do when the market pulls back. They want to be topping up their accounts, buying more stocks when things are on sale, so to speak.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Mitch, just real quick, because all of our financial planning partners, like, we get to catch up with them every month. And I ask them, like, how are things going? How's the Rask community faring? How are you finding them? And all of the financial planning partners that we deal with, they all say that exact same thing, is that I know when someone comes from the Rask community because they're asking like proper questions. They're asking the harder questions, and their knowledge is significantly further ahead than other places they might get people from. So that's actually a huge compliment. So
yeah,
kudos to everyone.
I'm doing a lot less basic explaining of how things work. And it's a much more deeper conversations about getting into rebalancing and you know, what their best, the best way to be adding funds is, like, on the frequency and things like that, rather than, you know, covering off the basic topics. And when I say the level of sophistication is really interesting, a lot of people say on surface level will look at what we do and say, oh, well, you're investing in ETFs. I can go out there and do that myself. Why would someone come to you and do it? Well, we've got people who are, every single client I've spoken to is way more than capable of investing in an ETF themselves. They're coming along because they are building their own business and want to just you know, put this aside. They know they should be investing. They know they should be saving. They want to put it aside and have someone that they trust to do it, or they are retired already, and they've got things they want to do in their life, and so they're, you know, once again looking for someone they trust with a investment process they understand, or then they could be retired, or you know, not retired, and very heavily active in managing that satellite component of their portfolio. Right. So like handpicking individual stocks and things like that. And they're very, very active in that respect. And so they actually just want to park the core or the passive side of things across to a manager like yourself. And so they can actually focus in on what they enjoy doing, which is the satellite component. So this isn't all about Rask Invest though. So just a couple of other little things. The 1 month catch-ups are going really, really well. We've actually had a couple of conversations with advisors who are keen to look at Rask Invest as an alternative investment option, and we're building out some functionality to assist them. So that's really interesting. And also, you know, it's a wide range of clients, and we're also starting to bring on some high net worth clients as well, which is wonderful.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I didn't expect the advisors to kind of come out of the woodwork in the way that they have. That's really surprised me straight away. And also, I think the Jeff Bezos analogy with Amazon Prime is, if you offer a free lunch, as in Amazon Prime was free delivery, the biggest eaters are the first ones to rock up. And and that's been really good to see too. People with really, really, really large balances approaching us. And what I've found is that, this is just my perspective, I haven't done nearly as many client comms as you have, but I've noticed that some of the people with the biggest portfolios not just recognize the fees and all that sort of stuff, and it's all taken care of, but they're also the most likely to outsource. And I think it's because, like you said, they want to focus their attention on other things. Like a lot of them run their own business or are entering retirement, and they do want to focus on the other things in life other than just looking at a brokerage screen day in, day out, and worrying if their stock's going up or down or whatever. Okay, so I've got one more question for you, and this is not necessarily for Rask Invest, but just generally, because you've been doing this for, what are we working out, like 15 years?
Yeah, about that. I know, yeah. I look much younger.
Yeah, you look 21. I guess, what are some of the mistakes that you've seen people make? Because people, you know, can make many different types of mistakes when it comes to investing, generally speaking. But in this regard, like in this way of investing, of building a diversified portfolio, what do you find? Or as in, what do you find for people that have a yield focus?
Yeah, so investing mistakes come in all shapes and sizes. And it's not always someone going for the next growth stock and blowing themselves up like that. Chasing dividends and overreaching for yield can be just as dangerous. Mm-hmm. So looking for those, you know, dividend traps. So people who just sort, you know, the shares by the highest dividend yield and purchase like that. But I mean, I don't think that's that common. But like saying looking at something that's yielding, you know, 8 or 9 or 7% or something like that, and jumping in. That's a sure sign of a dividend. That's a business that's going to cut its dividend. And then looking at the concentration risk, I think over my time frame, I've seen so many portfolios that are literally just the big four banks and Telstra for income. Yeah, that's some serious concentration risk there. And then ignoring diversification just all together. For so long, Australian investors have actually ignored investing overseas to the detriment of their own balances. I think that on specifically talking about yield there, it's because of our, you know, they fall in love with our franking credit system.
Yeah.
And the last one, and this one's really difficult to talk about, and it kind of plays into the, hey, someone who's owned the banks for forever and whatnot, but they get so focused on yield that they actually forget about total returns. And a really, really good example, there's some great examples out there actually of ETFs on the market that are very, very much advertised as income or yield ETFs, and the yield on them looks wonderful. However, if you step back and take a look at the total returns over 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, and compare them just to a bog standard index tracker, some of these are underperforming those index tracking ETFs by, say, like 3% per annum. Mm-hmm. And over a 10-year period, that 3% per annum compounding is significant. That's got a significant toll on your end balance.
Absolutely, it does. Total return is one of those mystical things. We had behavioral finance expert Simon Russell on the show last year, and he said that there seems to be this thing that when people hit retirement, they just go all in on passive income, like dividend income. And he's like, that's like one of the biggest biases that he sees when he works professionally with super funds or individual investors or whatever. It happens all the time. And as much as we try and illustrate that, hey, the actual end result is a total return. The way I like to think about that is if you expect a 10% return, what amount of that is going to come from dividend income? Historically, if you assume that the stock market had historically returned 10%, you would be looking at, say, $4, maybe, or 4%, sorry, of that return comes from the income component. And then there's a big growth component, which is really important for people in retirement, because that's what means that in year 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, you still have a nest egg and it's still capable of producing income. Whereas if you go all in on the income, you could be robbing Peter to pay Paul, and you'll eventually have a much smaller super balance. And so
that kind of goes back to that bucket strategy that we were talking about right at the start, where, you know, people are living a lot longer than they used to. So you could be spending 20 odd years plus in retirement easily, and need growth in there to fund your lifestyle well into the future.
Yeah.
And keep up with inflation as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So one of the topics that we wanted to talk about, because we did a passive income webinar last week with GlobalX, and it was really, really popular. So that's what the genesis of today's episode was, like, what are some of the key benefits of using ETFs to generate passive income? Well, there are many. I'm guessing neither of us will say that they're perfect, because they're not perfect, but are they superior to the other options that are available? In many instances, yes. Not all asset classes and not all types of investments, but in many instances, I'd say they are, Mitch.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of that comes down to the key benefits of ETF investing in general. And that's through it's their diversification, for one, that low cost diversification. Spread across sectors, spread across, it could be countries, industries, etc.
Yeah. I had someone, I wrote an article, which I shared with you, about how you can get potentially 5% in passive income from a quote unquote reliable portfolio. And someone on social media said that that's not real investing, as in implying that building a portfolio sensibly is actually not investing. What is investing in their mind was picking individual stocks and trading markets. And I always come back to that, you know, that quote from Morgan Housel, which was actually a headline of an article that he wrote in 2014, which was 99% of long-term investing is doing nothing. The other 1% changes your life. And I think people so often confuse it that, like, it's 99% effort and then you get the reward. I kind of think that that whole premise has been totally turned on its head, and people, I hope by now, understand that more trading tends to result in more tax, more fees, and lower returns.
And the chance of doing the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally. And this this probably ushers in a different discussion around ETFs, is that a lot of investors are, I'd say it's not a fair characterization, but I'll say it, is like particularly people that are well established in stocks, like individual stocks, they're probably less inclined to make the transition straight away. But after a few discussions, they tend to be more open to it because you can say, well, yeah, sure, you've got CommBank, and I've got my numbers here. What was it? You've got CommBank. CBA is 8% of an ASX 300 ETF, like VAS. So you still have your banks, as you said before, you still have your banks, you just hold them in a different way. Mm. And once they kind of realize that, it's actually the kind of the same thing. And then another good one is, like you mentioned, income focus. Like BHP had the progressive dividend policy until a few years ago when it cut its dividend, and then it wasn't progressive anymore. And it's the biggest dividend payer in Australia by a long way. And so when those dividends feed back to the community and investors, it really hurts. But if it's part of a diversified portfolio, you can mitigate the risk of that in some way. So it's still 9% of that ASX 300 ETF, of the VAS ETF. But it's weathered by, at the time, CommBank was raising its dividend, for example. Or Telstra, having cut its dividend, was then stable again. So I think that that's something that I notice repeatedly. It's like people eventually cotton on to that, oh, maybe the diversification actually aids my long-term returns and aids my income.
And a lot of them, I think there's also a bit of a hurdle and a barrier there because they've held these companies for so long and they make up such sure. And of course, changing your portfolio is, you know, making a change that big is a, well, for lack of a better term, a big change. Mm. So, but maybe it's something that they could do gradually over time as they grow. Like they could cut some of the weeds from their portfolio first, reallocate. If they're not yet in retirement mode, they could start to, instead of selling those stocks, they could actually allocate their savings instead of adding to those stocks, adding to ETFs, and then adding the dividends into the ETFs themselves as well, and rebalance over time. That's something that they can do that they might be more comfortable with doing rather than making one big drastic change.
I did notice there was a comment that came through the new RAS community, which I think it was from Jeremy, yeah, to sell or not to sell, around managing tax and those types of things. Now, ETFs are slightly different in that people still come into grips with this, is when you earn passive income, that income can also mean short-term capital gains and a different kind of tax makeup overall. You still get franking credits. Hmm. So if you think, like if we just, like the title of this podcast is like 5% in passive income. And if you think about the building blocks that go into making that, you effectively have probably 4%, maybe a little bit more, depending on which ETF you choose for the Aussie share market, but it will also pay franking credits. So let's call it, say, 5% for most people. Basically, what that means is that big chunk of your portfolio is already exceeding your target. So then the other parts can be cleaned up. And what basically that means is when you do your transition and you're kind of slowly blending ETFs into your existing portfolio, you're not giving up any return in income in the short term. Oftentimes, in fact, you're adding to it. And depending on whether you make your tax changes before retirement or after retirement, or take the losses now and then have some of the gains in retirement, that can actually have a big impact. But that's also worth calling out. So it doesn't need to be all or nothing. Jeremy's comment was more about, is it kind of like, do I do it or do I not do it? I think it's okay to revisit your strategy and it's okay to change. It's like, you know, everyone that drives down the highway and there's a big pothole and they all crash their cars. And then the engineer comes along and says, well, maybe we should fix that. And then the town planner says, yeah, but it wouldn't be fair to everyone who's already crashed. So, you know, the idea is that if you change it, yeah, sure, there's going to be some legacy issues. But at the same time, you've got to change it because you're going to be investing for 10 or 20 years. And we don't want to just make this about pumping up ETFs generally, but because we do invest actively and passively, and we would advocate for doing both of those things. But if we think about a 5% portfolio, if cash is paying 5%, you can get an Aussie bond ETF that pays, that has a yield of about 4%, maybe more. A global bond ETF that has a yield of about 4% or more. We've got the Aussie shares, obviously, over 5% with franking. US shares aren't yielding much, but they make up for it more than, again, in total return.
Yeah, I think you're looking at approximately 1.5% as an income from that.
Yeah, but it will make up for it time and time again in the income, in the growth column. And then if you looked at a floating rate bond ETF, so this is an ETF that doesn't invest in government bonds, it might invest in credit or hybrids or something. You're looking, I was just looking before this at the Sub-D ETF, SUBD from VanEck. That's yielding about 6.2% as a running yield. And what I actually looked at is I compared Sub-D, because we had a question on the difference between Sub-D and the FLOT, the float ETF. I think Drew mentioned that last week or the week before on the show. And basically, with the VanEck Sub-D ETF, we told our members to switch into this a while ago. It's a subordinated debt ETF. You get a lot of exposure to the banks. So it's kind of like you'd put it in the same bucket as your hybrid ETF. Many people will be familiar with the hybrid ETF, HBRD. That's an actively managed strategy. Over the past 1 year, based on my numbers that I can see online, it's returned 6.5%. And the Sub-D ETF over the past year, let me just get this up. I think it was 7.1% from Sub-D. But Sub-D, if we look at this, it's returned 1.3% in the share price, or like the capital growth, and 5.75% in the income column. So the floating rates are making a very decent return because of the income component and just getting by with the growth. So if we combine that into a portfolio where we're targeting a 5% income stream, it exceeds that and it's growing modestly. But I think if you start to go too much in the growth column, in the income column, you'll eventually start to get a negative return. And that's where you kind of get that sweet spot depending on the asset class. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm going to throw a question at you that I reckon if we were doing this recording right now live, someone would stand up and say, hey, but I can get 5%, if not just a little bit more, because I was just having a Google of the term deposit rates. I can get 5% on a government guaranteed term deposit and take no risk.
Yeah. And so that's what you would probably do. But we're talking about, that's why in our portfolios, not to talk about book, but if in our portfolios, we have a lot of cash. And so we have a lot of cash and government bonds. And the reason why we have both is because cash is effectively like month to month income and it's yielding a lot. But the problem is that if interest rates fall, the income that you receive on term deposits or even your cash account will start to fall and the government bonds would increase in value. So they'll actually, the capital component will go up to compensate for the lower return. Now, the opposite is also true, which is what we've kind of found out over the past month, which is that if the expectations for interest rates go up, your bond ETF, your government bond ETF will fall modestly. And so that's kind of happened. Whereas the floating rate ETFs like Sub-D, that would be expected to continue to yield more. But at the margin, you're right. Like you can get probably 5% from a savings account or like a term deposit, or you could get a 7.1% return over the past year. Past performance is not indicative of future performance and all that, but you could get an extra 2% from that. And while it might not seem like much, you're stepping out onto the risk curve, like you're stepping into risk. That 2% can make a very big difference for a lot of people, particularly when it's compounded out over multiple years. So yeah, you're right. You don't need to go all or nothing. I think that's a really important point is this might be a small allocation as a very diversified portfolio, as well as gold, Mitch. Gold is another one, Mitch, that has worked well in the short term as uncertainty has crept back in.
Yeah, I did hear a quote, and I think it was by Giselle Roux, the fund manager Giselle. I don't know if it was on your podcast, this podcast, Owen, or on a different one that she's done, maybe with Livewire. But I think she said that her and her team a while back, when this question was thrown at them, they had done the work on it. And I think over a rolling 12-month period, cash was almost never the highest performing asset.
Yeah.
I think that's another reason why you wouldn't be, say, 100% in in cash, even though that that was risk-free. Let's just have a quick look, actually. So
you're compensated for risk, right? That's what you're taking, right? Is if you look at the Vanguard charts, like that really, that long-term chart, really long-term chart, you'll see that the risky assets outperform. Not always, not every market condition, but they outperform because there's risk inherent in what you're doing with your money. And so it's not on or off necessarily. Like, I think if you just compared like emerging market stocks to cash, obviously that's two variables that are two different asset classes at very different ends of the spectrum. And you'd want to stagger your portfolio. You'd want to blend it across that spectrum, not necessarily go a barbell approach, which is sometimes what we hear on the podcast, is like, oh, we're going to have like 50% cash, 50% emerging markets. Like, that is a kind of real primitive way of thinking about portfolio allocation.
Now that you've built your portfolio, and speaking of cash, I just had a quick look. The Rask Invest Terra portfolio, you've currently got cash sitting at 17% of the portfolio. Just for everyone out there, we actually use, it's not just sitting as physical cash, we actually use a cash ETF by our show partners are BetaShares. So that is out there actively seeking out the best term deposit rates that it can get. So that's instead of us using term deposits in the portfolios. So AAA is the stock code for that. So Owen, we've built the portfolio. So you're getting this yield, etc. When and what opportunities do you look to rebalance?
Well, obviously, most investors listening to this should have some sort of basic rebalancing strategy. I would just say that do it if, not when. So if something is out of balance, then rebalance it. I think a lot of people say, well, every quarter I'll rebalance. But there's no rhyme or reason for that to be a necessity. Like, a lot of the ETFs that people have in their portfolios, or the diversified portfolios that you see and you can buy off the shelf, a lot of them have set rules, like rebalances monthly, rebalances quarterly. And what that actually does is it actually just creates taxable events for people. And it also creates frictional costs. So you lose money from slippage of trading. So ultimately, you don't want to rebalance unnecessarily. And if you take it a step further, you also don't want to rebalance if you can have assets in your portfolio that should be growing. So you don't want to just have it go up one month, cut it, go up another month, cut it, let your winners win, so to speak, and let them run a bit. And so for us, that would be around 10% of the portfolio being out of balance, meaning that, you know, our growth assets could grow significantly and then we would be forced to rebalance, but it would take a lot to do that. You might see something, but we deliberately did it that way because it might occur in an event like, say, COVID, or an event like the GFC, you would see us forced to rebalance. But I think that the benefits for anyone listening of having a rebalancing strategy is actually that it just gives you guidance when things are really uncertain, that you should do it. Because a lot of people say they will, like you mentioned before, I kind of like laughed internally a bit about a lot of the RAS community being focused on rebalancing and topping up their portfolios. A lot of us say that we'll do that, but unless we put the automation in place or we have a rule set in advance, we just don't do it because we're too scared. Because typically when the stock market falls 10 or 20%, there's a lot of other things going on in your life that compound that feeling of fear and you just become paralyzed. Whereas the rule gives you the ability to keep going.
Yeah, I remember when COVID hit, that was, a time when... being in Melbourne, I was walking around my backyard on the phone to, you know, team members and clients and whatnot alike, and we're seeing markets fall 5% in a day, or if not more. We're all locked down. I'm wondering if the company that I was working for at the time was going to make redundancies and things like that, because it was quite common in COVID, because no one knew what, you know, the tomorrow was going to look like, to take your savings and then jump into the market at that point in time, even though in hindsight, wonderful opportunity.
Yeah.
Brave is one way to put it, or it that might have been a, you know, it could have been a pretty foolish move at the same time as well.
Well, just look at the banks, you know, the any company that was cutting dividends. Travel companies obviously got absolutely taken to the cleaners. Even some of the hybrids that we saw, I believe some of the, I could be wrong, but I'm almost certain some of the NAB hybrids were converted. So that's triggered, meaning that you basically, they just exchange for shares, which is not what you want because it's not why you bought them. So these are the things that can happen. And many of us didn't know this in this case for COVID, like the COVID was going to wipe out 10% of the global population, right? Like actual apocalypse style thoughts running through your head. And then we didn't have rapid tests at the time. And if you go back to the GFC, no one even to this day really still understands what CDOs are and how they work and their effect on the economy and how that crippled, almost like just melted the financial system. So, you know, in those times of uncertainty, you really don't have all the answers. And so all you can really do is you can extend your time frame to look back over decades and say, well, in the past, this is the thing that kind of happened. And it seems like those things are lining up now. And you have those preset rules so that you can take away as much of that emotion as you can. And you can act with at least a little bit of confidence, knowing that you're basing your decision on some empirical data. And that's all we would do. But Mitch,
I've got a quick one. We're talking about market volatility here, and I want to throw one at you. The biggest retort that I would get to that extending your time frame would be from people already retired. They're like, hey, we can't extend our time frame. We can't go back and say, I'll retire in 3 years' time now and keep on saving. So how do they handle market volatility when they're relying on, say, things like ETFs for income?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And so I should have clarified when I say extend your time horizon. What I mean is just looking at the data set that's in front of you. Like a lot of people struggle from recency bias in a time of crisis. They'll say, well, you know, the stock market is down 20% now. This could continue for the next 6 months. Yeah. That's like COVID. But if you look back over 10 or 20 years, you would have seen that that's pretty common. It has happened before. It will probably happen again.
And recoveries do happen.
Absolutely.
In time.
Yeah, I remember we had Nick Griffin from Munro on the podcast, and he was suggesting at the time that, you know, a stock market crash like that might last 300 days, for example. That was just based on the data at the time. And it wasn't 300 days, as we knew. It kind of rallied straight back. And so those things, that's where you find comfort in the numbers during those times. And for a retiree, it basically comes down to just being more, thoughtful in how you build your portfolio. So you do include things like gold. You do include floating rate notes. You do include bonds. You do include different asset classes and different currencies, because you simply cannot afford to have the drawdown like a younger person that has 30 years to recover might be willing to accept. And the good news is, because of ETFs, you can do that. You can build that same portfolio that targets income, has a little bit of growth, is diversified, is low cost. You can do that with 5 to 10 ETFs. And that's probably on, you know, depending on who you are, maybe slightly on the lower side, but you can do that. And you know, to set up that portfolio is only going to cost you $50, $100 in trading, is in brokerage costs nowadays. So, and you're off to the races. So it's absolutely wonderful that people can do that. And that's kind of the world that we live in. But last one from me, Mitch, I think we've got to go and welcome a team member to the Rask family in just a moment. But I just wanted to tell you and remind you and tell everyone else that you can come and talk to us. Next week, we are hosting a live show with Mitchell and myself. It's available via the link in your show notes. We're actually going to do a walkthrough at Rask Invest. You'll get to see all of the portfolio top to bottom and see what it looks like, see which ETFs are in there, see why we've picked them and ask questions. We did one maybe a week or two ago, and it was really, really well received. So we're doing another one. This one will focus more on passive income and ETFs. And also, you can book a call with Mitch if you are interested in Rask Invest and exploring that. We will be back with regular programming this week with the Honourable Drew Meredith. But Mitch, always fun, mate, to pick your brain and just hear from you. And congrats on your first month of Rask Invest and all the work that you're doing, mate. It's great. So I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Owen. And a big thank you to all of the Rask Invest investors and the community as a whole, because the do jump in, actually, everyone who's listening to the RASC community. That's starting to really pick up some speed and getting some really interesting conversations going on there. And that's free. That's a free resource. So we're really hoping to see that build and develop and become a great point, focal point for like-minded investors. So it's been a really fun month. And thanks, Owen. It's been great.
Thanks, mate. Thanks, mate. It has been great. And thank you to everyone. We'll see you in the next episode. Bye for now.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the RASC Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.